Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. China opened the 19th Communist Party Congress today in Beijing, and the message from President Xi Jinping was that China should take center stage in the world. These meetings are held every 5 years to determine who will lead China and the course the country will chart. Joining us now is NPR's Rob Schmitz in Shanghai. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Jeremy.
And tell us more about what Xi said today and how his message is being received.
Yeah, Xi Jinping talked today about ushering in what he called a new era of socialism with Chinese characteristics. And on the face of it, that may sound sort of like a meaningless phrase. But for those of us who routinely sort of read the tea leaves of Chinese Communist Party jargon, it is a very interesting departure from his predecessors. He's sort of distinguishing himself from those leaders who came before him. And this makes a lot of sense because he's done a lot as leader in his first five-year term that was a departure from those before him.
And when he says he wants China to take center stage in the world, is that a message to the United States?
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's also a message for his own people. I think this tone is all about Xi Jinping and how he plans to rejuvenate China's standing in the world. And, you know, the one interesting thing that he mentioned today was that by the year 2050, his goal is to turn China into one of the most powerful countries of the world with a military that is one of the best in the world. You know, so his hope is that China by that year will be a country that the rest of the world looks up to for inspiration. And so, of course, this is definitely aimed at the United States.
Did he give any details about how he wants to make this happen?
Oh, did he give details? He had a 3.5-hour speech, you know, and these things are usually really choreographed, right? But, you know, it was so long that, you know, you really can't choreograph your bladder. So you had like leaders, former leaders of China that were, you know, kind of quietly leaving to take a bathroom break and go to the men's room. But yes, he gave hours and hours of details about how China will become this massive socialist force in the world. And a lot of it has to do with addressing a lot of the problems that face China today, which is namely the gap between the rich and the poor, because China has an enormous population and half of that population are still farmers. And so raising their income level, and then also all sorts of things from cleaning up the environment to making sure that China is on a path to innovation and technology, to raising the level of the military.
I was reading this morning that Xi Jinping is now seen as the most powerful Chinese leader, maybe since Mao. Why is he seen as so powerful?
Well, since he was selected as president 5 years ago, he's consolidated all the decision-making power in himself. He's in charge of the military. He's in charge of the economy. He's waged an unprecedented war on corruption within party ranks. And that has led to hundreds of thousands of government officials being investigated, some thrown into prison. You know, when he came to power, China's Communist Party was quickly losing its legitimacy among the people. And Xi Jinping has done a very thorough job so far of beginning to clean that party up. So his goal has always been to revive China's Communist Party and the country of China in the eyes of his own people. So yes, he's arguably, I know that comparison is often made with Mao, but I think it's becoming apparent that he is incredibly, incredibly powerful.
He's got a big crackdown on corruption going, and I'm reading this morning that at the party Congress, a lot of the delegates don't have flowers in their rooms. They don't have, fruit plates or whatever they might have had in the past, because he wants to show that he's implementing austerity.
Yeah, they also don't have coach bags. I mean, that was an issue in previous Congresses. You know, today, delegates are being driven up in Volkswagens, which is a big step down from the typical car of the communist cadre, which is the Audi. So yeah, they've taken a big step down as far as the car make and model as well.
Rob, in his 3.5-hour speech, did he talk at all about North Korea, which of course is one of the big issues for the United States when it comes to how China is able to put pressure on North Korea?
He didn't specifically mention North Korea. You know, North Korea is obviously a pretty sensitive issue among the leadership of China. It's, you know, its sole ally is China, and so China has to be careful about it. So this speech was mostly focused on a lot of the issues that face China and a lot of the goals that China is looking forward to because, you know, of course, it's a Communist Party Congress. So, yeah, North Korea wasn't mentioned outright by Xi, nor was the United States. But I think that, you know, as we mentioned, there were a lot of references to, you know, China's role in the world, which, of course, was aimed at other countries.
That's NPR's Rob Schmitz joining us from Shanghai as the Chinese 19th Communist Party Congress gets underway. Rob, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Well, in the U.S., many people reached for their checkbooks after the deadly streak of hurricanes that devastated South Texas, Florida, Puerto Rico. At least $350 million was raised for the victims of Hurricane Harvey in the first 3 weeks after that storm. But anytime there's a disaster, there are questions about what charities do with donations. Amy Costello covers philanthropy on her podcast, Tiny Spark, and has our story.
When Hurricane Harvey hit South Texas, donors were advised to think twice before giving to the American Red Cross. The New York Times editorial board urged readers to ask for, quote, greater accountability from trusted charities like the American Red Cross. On Twitter, hashtags such as No Red Cross cropped up in the wake of the storm. Brian Mittendorf is a professor at Ohio State University specializing in nonprofit accounting. He says the fact that after recent disasters, people are expressing concerns about the Red Cross is new.
In the past, anytime something like this came up, the default was everyone just donates to the Red Cross, end of story. And that didn't put much pressure on the Red Cross.
The Red Cross has been under pressure from donors big and small after investigations by NPR, ProPublica, and others revealed wasteful spending and unkept promises after the 2010 earthquake in Haiti and Hurricane Sandy. The Red Cross declined a request for an interview, but sent a statement that said in part, "Disasters by their nature are chaotic, and that means that things sometimes don't go as planned, so we readjust accordingly to meet the mission." Still, Mittendorf says the organization's credibility gap has opened doors for other relief organizations.
So I see a positive development is that people see there being more options.
Options like giving to small, local organizations or to nonprofits that do one specific thing, like diaper banks or animal rescue groups. New nonprofits are cropping up all the time, and Mittendorf says that raises new concerns.
There's so many ways to donate at this point. You now have ways where you can do GoFundMe campaigns. And, you know, in terms of how vetted things are, some of these GoFundMe campaigns have no vetting and no scrutiny.
GoFundMe is a popular crowdfunding platform that lets individuals raise money for their own personal causes. So does a site called YouCaring, which is the platform NFL star J.J. Watt chose when Hurricane Harvey hit Houston, his adopted hometown. Watt raised more than $37 million in the span of 3 weeks. A publicist for the Houston Texans would not make anyone available for an interview, but said Watt has yet to distribute any of the money and will announce plans for spending it in the coming weeks. Meantime, Google and Facebook have helped raise millions of charitable dollars from the public, too. They also need to figure out how to vet the nonprofits they help raise money for.
Both of them are looking for ways to be more strategic and more effective in their disaster giving. So we've been working together to kind of think about that.
Bob Ottenhoff is president and CEO of the nonprofit Center for Disaster Philanthropy based in Washington, D.C. After Hurricane Harvey, Facebook and Google pointed donors to Ottenhoff's organization. That publicity helped the center pull in about $12 million for Hurricane Harvey alone. It will now dole that money out over the next year or so, mostly to organizations involved in long-term recovery work. Ottenhoff says it's important to scrutinize groups you plan to give to, which is what he's doing now.
We want to know about the capabilities and the capacities of these organizations. You know, it's one thing to have the desire to do it. We want to make sure they've actually got the ability to get done what was going to be needed.
And as you try to vet groups you give to, you may be inclined to ask a seemingly simple question. How much of every dollar I give goes to overhead, and how much goes directly to actually helping people?
I get why donors want to know the answer, but I also think the most honest answer is to say we don't know for sure. because it's not so straightforward.
That's Ohio State's Brian Mittendorf again, talking about groups like the Red Cross that do a lot of direct relief in multiple locations. When we demand that the bulk of our donation goes to helping people and not to overhead, it can create perverse incentives. Mittendorf says to keep overhead low, nonprofits may simply pass your donation on to another charity rather than doing the actual work themselves.
In the end, we ultimately want organizations that don't just say, "I gave it to the cause," but operate. That's the area where I think the Red Cross is facing some unfair criticism. They're doing the hands-on work, and sure, they've made some mistakes along the way, but it's just this notion of the incremental dollar that I need the absolute maximum amount of that dollar to be spent on what people would refer to as a program. It does create this incentive for an organization to be so lean that it's not able to accomplish anything.
For its part, the Red Cross says it worked across 8 states, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands responding to the recent hurricanes. They're in California now, too, where they say they gave shelter to almost 5,000 people escaping the wildfires. For Here and Now, I'm Amy Costello.
And it's been more than 2 weeks since the shooting in Las Vegas left 58 people dead, more than 500 wounded. Perhaps one of the biggest question marks centers on security guard Jesus Campos at the MGM Resort's Mandalay Bay Hotel, who was shot through a door in the hallway after he went to check a jammed fire door. Campos has been out of the public eye, even described as missing. He skipped scheduled interviews, fell out of contact with his union reps helping coordinate his appearances. But today his silence is broken in an episode of the Ellen DeGeneres Show. A nervous-looking Campos tells her about walking down that 32nd floor hallway and being shot.
As I was walking down, I heard rapid fire. And at first, I took cover. I felt a burning sensation. I went to go lift my pant leg up and I saw the blood. That's when I called it in on my radio that shots have been fired.
Campos had already called in a colleague on the MGM maintenance staff, Stephen Schuck, who was coming to join him in the hall, when he saw Campos peek out of an alcove.
And that's when Jesus, he leaned out and he said, "Take cover, take cover," and yelled at me. And within milliseconds, if he didn't say that, I would have got hit.
And they then endured a hail of bullets. Casey Morell of KNPR in Las Vegas is with us. Casey, how much of a surprise was this that Campos is showing up on this show?
Well, Robin, MGM had said that Jesus Campos wasn't missing. He would talk to the media when he was ready to talk. So maybe the surprise was more the venue that he chose than anything else, that he decided instead of doing these news interviews that he had been scheduled to appear on, that he was sitting down with Ellen DeGeneres on her talk show.
Right. And tell us more about what he said about what happened that we don't know about that night.
What he's been talking about was related to the timeline of events, what happened the night leading up to the shootings at the Route 91 Harvest Country Music Festival. Campos said that a door had been left open. There was some sort of alert on a door at Mandalay Bay that told security officials to go check on it. He went up to the 32nd floor from a stairwell on the 31st and encountered a blocked door that forced him to go another route, which is what led to his eventual shooting.
He thought he heard a jackhammer walking down the hall. He thinks now that he alerted the shooter that he was right outside the door. We know there were cameras there, and apparently he made a noise, a door slammed, and that's when he was shot. But does he answer any questions about the timeline? Because the Las Vegas police had given different timelines about when he arrived on the floor and when their police arrived.
Right. So the latest timeline that Las Vegas Metropolitan Police have come up with suggests that Campos was shot much closer to 10:05 p.m., which is when the gunfire started to come down from the 32nd floor of Mandalay Bay onto the crowd of people attending this country music festival. Campos seemed to suggest that that is what happened to him, because after he realized he had been shot and the engineer that you mentioned was coming up to the floor to also see what was going on, more gunfire was coming down the hallway and then subsequently out of the building.
There had been a whiff of mystery about him, but also a whiff of suspicion. You know, some people wondered where he was and why they weren't hearing more. Does this clear some of that up?
I think it does to a certain degree. You know, as I said earlier, MGM had always maintained that Jesus Campos was not missing. He just simply did not want to talk to the media. You know, there were photos in newspapers, both here locally and nationally, of the front of his house, which had a no trespassing sign on it that explicitly said no media, no interviews. So he definitely did not want to talk to the press, at least at first. He wanted to take his time before deciding who he would talk to and when he would talk. And this is clearly the venue that he chose.
Well, and just in the images we've seen, he and Chuck appear still traumatized. And he told Ellen DeGeneres he won't be talking anymore.
Yeah, Campos said that he was doing better each day. But as you said, they were still visibly shaken up by this. I mean, they were some of the first people to see what was going on and to kind of get some sort of glimpse at what was to come later that night. So it's not surprising that they are still feeling some of the traumatic after effects from it.
Yeah. Well, he's getting some criticism for ditching the other interviews. But, you know, who can blame him? Who wouldn't rather sit and talk to Ellen DeGeneres if he can? But meanwhile, Casey Morell, what's the mood there in Las Vegas? The focus of the media has gone to Northern California. How are people feeling there?
Robin, it's still a bit surreal here. You know, people are still coming to terms with what has happened, even though we're 2.5 weeks out from the shooting. There are talks about, you know, what kind of memorial is going to be put in place to commemorate what has happened. You know, the thing that I think a lot of people don't realize is that Las Vegas is at its heart a small town, and it's hard to find somebody who doesn't either know someone who is directly affected by this or wasn't directly affected themselves. So the town is still trying to come together to grieve and commemorate what happened. And I think that process is going to be ongoing for some time.
Casey Morell of KNPR in Las Vegas, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, when the shooting happened in Las Vegas, people attending the concert suddenly found themselves delivering emergency first aid to strangers. Some fashioned makeshift tourniquets that helped slow bleeding. And our next guest says more people should learn how to do that in a crisis. Andrew Fisher is a volunteer with an awareness campaign called Stop the Bleed. He served as an Army Ranger and a physician's assistant on 8 combat tours. His regiment managed to dramatically cut deaths by training all personnel on how to use tourniquets. He's now attending medical school as a Tillman Scholar at Texas A&M. Andrew, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
So it makes sense that this would be something you would need to know in combat, but you say civilians should know how to do this as well.
Yeah, so there was a recent study or report, I should say, that came out of the National Academies of Science, Engineering, Medicine. And what they found was there was some similarities between preventable deaths in combat and what we see in the civilian setting. So they found that in 2014, about 30,000 people, or 20%, may have survived if there would have been an appropriate and timely medical care delivered after the injury. And largely that was due to bleeding. So can we as society decrease the amount of preventable deaths or potentially survivable deaths if we can simply teach everyone how to control hemorrhage from an extremity?
Well, how difficult is it for just an ordinary person to deal with a tourniquet?
When it comes to hemorrhage control, tourniquets, the ones that are proven to be effective, are not necessarily difficult to operate. It doesn't take much training in order to be proficient in the application, but certainly just like any other skill, it is perishable, and you should maintain some sort of regular training to ensure that you're proficient in your application.
And many people who have taken first aid classes and have learned how to use a tourniquet have also been taught that if they do so, the person is probably going to lose that limb. Is that true?
Right. So the old tourniquet and you're going to lose your limb scenario, it's for the most part false. Tourniquets have been used on thousands of extremities in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the result is that zero limbs were lost due to that tourniquet use. We absolutely know that 2 hours of tourniquet time is safe, and you will not have any necessarily bad outcomes. And I can't say 100% that is, you know, you're not going to have any adverse effects, but certainly, by and large, 2 hours of tourniquet time is very safe and with very little adverse outcomes in people who have them applied.
Is this the kind of thing that is common enough that people should know how to do it the way that they may know how to do CPR or the Heimlich maneuver?
I believe so. If you look at some of the data from out-of-hospital cardiac arrest survival rates, it's not very good, yet we still teach it to a lot of people, and we should. If we can save lives, we should definitely put forth the effort. The problem is I don't think we're putting forth that same effort for bleeding control. I think if you look at the instances like Las Vegas and other terrorist activities, it does cause people to discuss it and talk about it and get the training at that time, but we kind of see that interest just kind of dissipate. It'd be nice if we could find a way to keep that movement alive, because I think overall, if you look at how easy it is to control hemorrhage and the outcomes that you could receive from simple, you know, hemorrhage control is probably greater than what you could probably see with, you know, everyone learning CPR. You know, a lot of people who go into cardiac arrest have pre-existing conditions that at the end state, they're probably not going to survive based upon some of the data. But people who have accidents at home or on the road, you know, car accidents, and then they have this bleeding, certainly they can survive with simple bleeding control maneuvers.
What if someone doesn't have a tourniquet when they need one? Can they use a belt or something else?
Well, you know, like bleeding control says, you know, you should be able to apply direct pressure or pack a wound. Things like belts haven't been demonstrated to be very effective when it comes to improvised tourniquets. I think the important thing about improvised tourniquets is to ensure that it has some sort of windlass, which the windlass is the device that allows you to tighten that tourniquet in order to control the bleeding. As long, I think if you understand the mechanisms of a tourniquet, ensuring that it's wide enough, ensuring that you can tighten it with a windlass, and then secure that windlass, I think is the key to improvising a tourniquet.
That's Andrew Fisher, who is a volunteer with the Stop the Bleed campaign. He served as a physician's assistant during 8 tours of duty in Afghanistan and is now a Tillman Scholar studying to be a physician at Texas A&M. Andrew, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
If you've flown recently, you may have gotten more than just a bag of pretzels and coach, perhaps an entire free meal. After more than a decade, some legacy airlines are reintroducing free meals on domestic flights, but only on certain routes. Seth Kaplan is managing partner at Airline Weekly and joins us now. Hi, Seth.
Hey, Jeremy. Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure to have you, and always a pleasure to get fed while flying. But what do you have to do to find these flights that are offering free meals?
Yeah, well, it's Delta especially, American too to some degree, that have restored the free meals on transcontinental flights. So we're talking about flights between, you know, the east coast of the U.S. and the west coast. In Delta's case, it's about a dozen routes, you know, ones you would guess. Let's say New York JFK to San Francisco, Boston to San Francisco, Los Angeles, but also some more obscure ones. Seattle, Raleigh, Durham has those free meals as well. American has matched Delta in the markets where they compete directly, which is basically going to be New York to San Francisco and Los Angeles.
Now, a lot of airlines canceled free meal service and cut back other services because they were struggling financially after 9/11. Is this a sign that the airline industry is finally doing well again?
It is doing well again. And look, I mean, they're not going to give back everything that they took away. You know, from their perspective, they think they never should have been allowing free checked bags and that sort of thing. But, you know, now that they are doing well, it gives them the opportunity now that they're not just sort of struggling to get through the day to say, you know, what are some of those things that maybe don't cost a lot of money and make people really happy and, you know, give people a reason to fly a full service airline rather than those ultra low cost airlines that are out there, airlines like Spirit. You know, if American expects people to pay same order to fly American, it has to give them a reason to do that. And these are some of those reasons why somebody might now choose one of those airlines again.
Now, earlier this year, there was a lot of fanfare about some of the airlines offering this new basic economy, which was going to be cheaper, no frills. And they were saying this is going to allow people to fly for less money. But last month, during American Airlines Media Day, the company's president admitted that the airline's new basic economy fare is not a price cut. It's actually replacing what used to be main cabin fares. What's going on here?
Yeah, well, you know, his audience, when he says something like that, he's not trying to please passengers. He's trying to please investors who are nervous that there are all these cheap airfares out there and what that might do to airline profits. Look, to some degree, it's semantics. I mean, call it what you will. The reality is that there are a lot of cheap airfares out there right now, including on airlines like American, United, and Delta. And, you know, it's just kind of a question of what you're willing to give up. I mean, the rule kind of always is, look, if you can't travel light, you know, then maybe a very bundled airfare, you know, Southwest, right, of course, with the free checked bags is the airline for you. But if you're willing to give up a lot, you can save money by flying on those basic economy fares.
Seth, just a few seconds left, but a new survey finds that consumer approval ratings for airlines have actually been increasing. What do you make of that?
Yeah, look, in mundane ways, airlines are doing a better job. Most of us aren't going to ever get dragged off an airplane. You know, that's right. You know, those sorts of things don't happen a lot. But, you know, they're on time. They're not losing our bags as much. When they do that, most of us are happier.
That's Seth Kaplan, managing partner at Airline Weekly. Seth, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Today, President Trump met with members of the Senate Finance Committee to talk about two big items on his agenda, taxes and health care. In a tweet this morning, Trump appeared to walk back his support for a bipartisan deal struck yesterday by Senators Lamar Alexander and Patty Murray. Trump had this to say ahead of today's Senate Finance Committee meeting.
Well, we'll see the bipartisan. We're going to see the bipartisan, and Lamar Alexander's working on it very hard from our side. And if something can happen, that's fine. But I won't do anything to enrich the insurance companies, because right now the insurance companies are being enriched. They've been enriched by Obamacare like nothing anybody's ever seen before.
Let's bring in our political strategist, Angela Rye, the Democratic strategist. Hi, Angela.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. And Paris Denard, our Republican strategist. Hi, Paris.
Hello, hello, hello.
So, guys, this bipartisan health plan, it was to help insurance companies continue to cover low-income working Americans. This is not the very poor. That's Medicaid. It would benefit many Trump voters. And Catherine Rampell, the Washington Post columnist, I'm reading her in Oregon's Register Guard, is one of many who's asking, why would Trump supporters support this? It's against their best interest, you know, getting rid of the subsidy. She writes, maybe they believe any big government expansions would disproportionately go to the wrong kinds of people, people unlike themselves. Paris, if the president really doesn't go along with expanding this subsidy for at least 2 years, which yesterday he said he wanted, isn't this going to backfire on him?
I don't know if it's going to backfire on the president, but I do know that at the end of the day, the president wants the best deal, and he is very focused on ensuring that it's the better deal for the American people and not the insurance companies. And that is what the focus is. So if you have to get down to the details of every bill, and as the White House gets down to the details, if they find that it doesn't align with what the president's goals are, which is support for and tax, not tax, but affordable health care for the American people,
right,
then you're going to see him go back to the negotiating table and not going to move forward.
We are hearing that there's talk of adding some wording so that it's ensured that this money does go to paying for these premiums.
Right, and that is what is important to the president. That is important to the White House, and that frankly is important to those Republicans in leadership who understand that they need to have a win. Again, we've been saying it for 7 years now: repeal and replace. Well, you've got to do something that is for the American people. That's why you saw the president with these health care executive orders, and that's why you see him supporting this plan, but not supporting it to the point that it does not do what the intent is, which is to benefit and help the American people.
Well, some Republicans are looking past the health care debate and saying if they want to get a win, it's going to be on tax cuts. Angela, let me turn to you. What are Democrats going to do? Do you expect some of them will support whatever tax cut package comes through?
Well, Jeremy, you know I would love to answer this question, but we can't just breeze past healthcare like that. Because, you know, of course, I have a rebuttal. And so let me say very – I know, surprise! Let me just say very quickly, it's very clear that Donald Trump doesn't want to just create affordable care, healthcare opportunities for the American people after trying to sabotage and being caught on the record saying just that, that he wanted to sabotage and end Obamacare. The executive orders don't make healthcare more affordable or more easily accessible to the American people. In fact, it makes it so people with prior existing conditions have a more difficult time, the very thing that the ACA was designed to kind of fight against. And so I really am proud of my hometown senator, Senator Patty Murray, for the work that she did in a bipartisan matter. And bipartisanship, my friends, has been going out of the window under this administration in record numbers. So it's great to see them trying to work towards something. As it relates to tax reform, I think it's once again going to depend. The Democratic Party is a big tent party for a reason. It's one that looks out for the little guy and really looks like they're being called to the carpet on that front and center under this administration at every turn. And so they're going to have the responsibility of ensuring that whatever tax reform proposal that's put forth doesn't overly impact small businesses, doesn't overly impact working class.
So it sounds like you're leaving the door open. And we've heard this from Senator Wyden, too, that some Democrats may support the tax cuts.
Yeah, if it makes sense. And I think that is the million-dollar question.
Okay. Well, I want to take up the war of words over words that presidents use with families of fallen soldiers. This week, President Trump suggested former President Obama did not contact families of soldiers killed in action. Here he is on Fox News.
Now, as far as other representatives, I don't know. I mean, you could ask General Kelly, did he get a call from Obama? You could ask other people. I don't know what Obama's policy was. I write letters and I also call. Now, sometimes, you know, if you had a tragic event with it's very difficult to be able to do that. But I have called, I believe, everybody, but certainly I'll use the word virtually everybody.
Okay, put aside that General Kelly, whose son was killed in action, did go to a Gold Star dinner and sat with the Obamas. But yesterday, Donald Trump did call a widow of one of the soldiers, the four soldiers killed in Niger. That's how this all came up. Now, Congresswoman Frederick Wilson of Florida said Trump told the widow in the phone call that her son must have known what he signed up for, but still it must have hurt. Now, Trump tweeted out he didn't say that and he had proof. But of course, the Washington Post Paris reached out to the mother of the soldier. They're now reporting that she told the Post that Trump, quote, did disrespect my son. She was present during the call, and that President Trump said to the widow of the soldier, you know, your husband must have known what he signed up for. Look, Paris, is this a president who just has trouble with empathy?
No, I don't think this is a president who has trouble with empathy. I think this is a president who has trouble with getting a fair and balanced approach to what he says and what he does through the media. Mm-hmm. I think that there's by no means Frederica, the congresswoman, Frederica Wilson, excuse me, is a fan of the president's. And I don't think the Washington Post is showing itself to be one.
But the mother of the soldier is confirming it.
But listen, every soldier who goes into battle knows that they run the risk of giving paying the ultimate sacrifice. That's what makes our soldiers and any person who's either a first offender or a soldier such a hero. And so the fact that the president might have said something to that around that is not a bad thing. It is a fact, and it is something to be celebrated. It's something to be honored. That is why we salute them, and that's why the president says his policy is to call, and it's his policy to write letters. And so he just like President Obama, has held Gold Star family events like the General Kelly attended under the Obama administration. But this is why we honor and celebrate these heroic men and women who put their lives on the line every single day for our freedoms. Because they know that they're going to go, and that is a possibility. And that's why they're here.
Paris, using more words doesn't make this sound any better, my friend. But I will tell you, you know, Donald Trump isn't particularly the most empathetic person we've ever had in office. And I think to point to that, we can look to what he said about John McCain, who I think, Paris, you would argue is a hero. during the campaign, right? He's got something, some type of vendetta against soldiers. And I think it's clear not only in this call, but also with what he said about someone who is known to be a maverick
and when it's needed,
bipartisan.
Let me then get to some sound from John McCain to wrap up our segment here. This is Senator McCain, who, of course, is battling brain cancer now, speaking on Monday night at the Liberty Medal ceremony.
To fear the world we have organized and led the three quarters of a century, to abandon the ideals we have advanced around the globe, to refuse the obligations of international leadership and our duty to remain the last best hope of Earth for the sake of some half-baked, spurious nationalism cooked up by people who would rather find scapegoats than solve problems is as unpatriotic as an attachment to any other tired dogma of the past that Americans consigned to the ash heap of history.
Paris, what did you think when you heard Senator McCain say that?
I think Senator McCain's in the twilight of his career, and he is focusing on building his legacy and saying things that he believes from his heart. If that's what the senator believes, I think he has very much the right to say that. But I think it's going back to what Angela says. The president does not have a vendetta against soldiers. He honors soldiers. He honors veterans. And that is the greatest honor of one of the things that you do as president of the United States is being the commander-in-chief. And it's something he takes very seriously, as did President George W. Bush. And I know President Barack Obama did as well.
We're going to have to leave it at that. That's Paris Denard, Republican strategist. Angela Rye, our Democratic strategist, weighing in. It's only Wednesday in the events of the week. Paris, Angela, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Robert. It's here and now. So what happens now that Congressman Tom Marino, President Trump's nominee for White House drug czar, has withdrawn his name from consideration after that scathing Washington Post 60 Minutes report pointing out Marino's ties to the drug industry? And what happens to the bill Marino pushed through Congress, legislation backed by the drug industry, which weakens the Drug Enforcement Administration's, the DEA's, ability to keep drug companies from selling opioids to bad actors on the black market? Well, Lev Fascher is Washington correspondent for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Lev, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And start by briefly reminding us more about what was in that bill.
The meat of the bill, the controversial element, was a provision that made it extremely difficult, essentially, for the Drug Enforcement Agency to freeze shipments from drug distributors it viewed as suspicious. That was obviously not a popular provision once it came to light in the Washington Post 60 Minutes report. And it looks now that a bill from Senator Claire McCaskill, who's a Democrat from Missouri, is likely to be successful in repealing that law from last year.
Well, is there likely to be bipartisan support for a repeal? I mean, as you mentioned, it was pretty shocking for everyone to hear this report from Sunday that, in fact, the DEA could not stop the drug industry from, you know, these shipments of drugs to, as we said, bad actors on the black market. So it would seem as if everyone would want to get rid of that.
You know, it's still unclear. Orrin Hatch, who's the Republican from Utah, had not been a fan of the Post's reporting. He seems unlikely to support a repeal. At the same time, Shelley Moore Capito, who's a Republican from West Virginia, had said essentially she would support repealing the bill. In the House, it's unclear. I've heard there are some potentially bipartisan efforts afoot. Democrats obviously are going to be broadly supportive of repealing the 2016 law. It seems it's likely to be repealed. It's unclear how much Republican support there will be. But that's the state of play right now.
Right. Well, and what about the position of drug czar? This is the head of the Office of National Drug Control Policy. I mean, we're in the middle of a huge epidemic, over 200,000 people dead. Are there any other names being floated?
There are a couple names that are starting to very tentatively circulate. There's Frank Ginta, who is a former Republican congressman from New Hampshire, who is said to have been vetted by the administration earlier this year for the position. He lost a race after a campaign finance scandal, but is also the co-founder of the Bipartisan Heroin Task Force in the House of Representatives, so he's a candidate. Governor Chris Christie, actually, who chairs the president's commission on the opioid crisis, is said to be a candidate. The issue there is he is in office until January. It's not clear whether he'd be interested even in the position or in stepping down from the governorship earlier than that. but he has a track record of policy work, not to mention a $200 million initiative in the state of New Jersey that he just rolled out a few weeks ago, which is being billed by some as a potential national model for how to deal with the opioid crisis. There's also Bertha Madras, who sits on that commission, is a Harvard professor, worked on the demand reduction side at the Office of National Drug Control Policy under George W. Bush. So a couple good candidates who have been involved in this work, a couple other names floating around, but it's unclear when they'll appoint a new ONDCP director, and it's worth bearing in mind they also don't have a long-term Health and Human Services Secretary as of today.
Well, a couple of things. Chris Christie has been really tough on this issue. You mentioned he has a report coming out next month. His interim report was very tough. What might we hear, just very briefly, that might be interesting and new from the new report?
So we'll know more after Friday when the commission has, I believe, its final in-person meeting before that November report is issued. That meeting focuses on insurance. I think we'll see much more in the report about the role that insurers and health providers specifically can play in combating the epidemic. But it'll also be interesting to see if President Trump or the Department of Health and Human Services does declare this a public health emergency, what elements of the commission's interim report are included.
Well, some of the things that states want, more access to overdose reversal drugs at a lower cost or no cost, some policy changes to the way Medicaid reimburses for substance use, more money to fight addiction by getting funds elsewhere. So these are some of the things people want.
Yeah, there are things the president could potentially do. A lot of people are hoping he eliminates what's called the IMD exclusion, which prevents federal Medicaid money from being used for reimbursements at addiction treatment facilities with more than 16 beds. A lot of people say that's a big bottleneck just in terms of capacity for delivering addiction treatment. There are other people who worry that that's not quite the panacea some people think it is, and that it'll lead to a good amount of low-quality care being delivered that could cause more problems down the line. And there's also the potential, and the administration doesn't need to use the emergency declaration to do this, for using the Strategic National Stockpile, which the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention runs, to distribute some drugs and some treatment capacity, potentially open some health centers staffed by local workers to better serve people in need of addiction treatment who are not currently receiving it.
Lev Fasher, Washington correspondent for STAT. It feels like the fight against opioid addiction and the crisis in this country may get back on the radar again. Lev, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.